G'day, and welcome to this episode of the Humans of Agriculture podcast. I'm also going to say konnichiwa because I'm recording this intro from outside of Starbucks here in Tokyo. Today, we're sitting down with one of the 2023 Syngenta Growth Awards winners. James Carl's story is fascinating, and it's one of these moments where I just absolutely love the chance to sit across someone and pick their brain and ask them questions about something that I'm really genuinely interested in, whether it was family business, succession, how he actually manages his time between what he's doing in the paddock and with various boards. But what I didn't probably realise walking in was that over 60 years ago, an American farmer would be sitting down reading the American Farm Bureau magazine. Unbeknown to him, it was a moment that would prove pivotal to the development of Australia's cotton industry, and Australian agriculture would actually never look the same again from the 1960s. James's father was truly a pioneer in Australia's cotton industry, and so it was incredible to be able to pick his brain and chat about all of that and the history and what it was like coming to Australia as an American kind of 10 or 12 year old, and what it's been like to build his career in agriculture over the last 50 plus years. So let's jump into this one. Enjoy it. And if you want to hear any more about any of these topics, I think James is probably someone we'd love to sit down with again in the future. So if you've got any questions, hit us up. Maybe we can take them to him. James, firstly, I guess I saw your very, very brief speech at the Syngenta Growth Awards.
It was brief.
It was very brief. I think all you said was thank you and walked off. So if we can just make a pact that we'll get a little bit more out of you today, would be great.
More comedy, you can't stop me.
No, James.
The problem there was that it was a case of I'm accepting an award, which I'm not accustomed to for a start, but I'm also not accustomed to taking accolades, and I'm going, I'm really uncomfortable here right now. So that was the issue. If we were just having a yarn, you would have been struggling to get me off the stage.
Okay, well, we'll see how long this one goes.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I'm going to say I don't even know where to start today. I think your story, what you've done, we've been chatting for probably been an hour now, just off air about the different areas of agriculture that you and your family are involved in. And I think we've only touched the surface, but let's start at the Syngenta Growth Awards. That's where I first saw you. What was running through your head when your name was read out as one of the Growth Awards winners?
I did say when I got up there that I was thrown because I fully walked into the room and sat down with the intention and expectation that I was just going to be supporting and clapping on and supporting the winners. And I'd settled into a meal and a couple of good red wines, and I thought, this is going to be really fun. So everyone says they weren't expecting it. I was just clearly there thinking this is good fun. And the reward for me was going to be the networking that earlier that afternoon. I met some really intelligent people. And a good lot of people from all across Australia and New Zealand. And I thought, I'm going to follow some of these guys up because they're really interesting people. And I'm really pleased I'm now part of that network, and I've got somewhere to go and chase people up and talk about what they've done. Because we only touched on the surface of what they'd done in that afternoon networking as well. And I just thought, this is going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it.
You say some impressive people in the room. You and your story is incredibly impressive just in and of itself. Do you feel like an imposter in that room when you see what other people have been up to?
No, I don't. No, I don't. I'm not that humble. I'm well aware. I've had a really blessed life, and I've said before that I've got such a variation in the careers I've had, and even overlapping each other and coinciding with each other. So I just had such wonderful opportunities, and it all started with as far as innovation and I won't use sustainable because that's another story. Innovation and development of whether it's an industry, a company, or a project, that to me has just always been exciting, and it's a driver. And that came from my upbringing, and that came from dad, of course, but it came from landing in Australia as a 10-year-old with parents and his partners that were going to build a industry which became regularly in the top five exporting industry, agriculture industries in Australia, out of nothing. And literally it was out of nothing because everything required as support mechanisms and infrastructure for growing cotton in Australia wasn't here. So you had to be innovative and you also had to be positive because it would have been really easy to just go, this is all too damn hard. We never realised we're going home. But that was never in the back of Dad's head. And that's the way I grew up. That's never going to be in the back of your head.
So I want to ask you, at 10 years old, you moved out to Australia from?
California, yep.
And your dad decided WeWar. Can I ask why? Had he been on multiple trips here? Why WeWar?
Yeah, that's not a long story. There was a Hungarian plant breeder who applied for a job breeding wheat for the New South Wales Department of Agriculture in 1959. So he was here already. And he was working at the Watsonet Research Institute in Narrabri and breeding wheat for the department. And he was a pretty clever man. He was doing fine. What he was also, as a Hungarian, was a cotton breeder back there. And he was working here in Narrabri and he just recognised the soil types, the climate, the fact that Keeper Dam was nearing completion. And he was well aware that there were no licenses, irrigation licenses being issued because there was no demand for them. And he just thought, this is really weird. And this is the perfect opportunity to build a cotton industry. And Australia at that time had 5 cotton mills. They only consumed about 200,000 bales a year between them. But all of that was virtually imported. The only cotton produced in Australia at that time, there had been a cotton industry in Australia for the previous 20, 30 years, but it was dwindling. And the reason it was dwindling is because it was based on 1930s technology and it never moved forward. So it was just not working, not happening. The only cotton gin left in Australia was a little old one in the middle of Brisbane. And the only real cotton being grown was in central Queensland with heavily subsidised production. And the quality of that was with varieties that were so old that mostly the cotton was unspinnable. So the mills were importing virtually all their needs. And Nick was sitting in Narrabri breeding wheat. So he went to his bosses and said, look at this opportunity. And they said, short term, shut up and breed wheat. And enough of talk about that. So he tried again sometime later and got the same response from some different people. And he thought, I don't know what's going on. This is really weird, but someone's got to know about this. So he printed an article in the American Farm Bureau magazine, which goes to every farmer in America. And both my dad and his partner, Frank Headley, picked up on the article because they all both subscribed to it. And they're chatting about it at Rotary or church one day, wherever they caught up, and said, we should go and have a look. So that's how they came here.
Incredible. What made your old man, Paul and Frank Hadley, the people to really get the industry going here in Australia? What were their characteristics?
Dad had already decided he didn't want to be a farmer in California anymore. And Frank was the same. Dad was more row cropping. Frank was an orchardist, growing stone fruits mostly. Both of them were feeling over-controlled in that the government, the California government at that time, and they didn't get much better actually, it just absolutely controlled what you grew and with quotas and subsidisation. So we had a moderate-sized farm for California in those days. It's about 350 acres. To utilise that, Dad was growing 8 different crops because they were all restricted to 30 acres of that, 40 acres of lucerne, 25 acres of walnuts, 50 acres of almonds, rah, rah, rah. So he had to have the capital equipment for each one of them. So it was just ridiculous. There's no way he could make money. And all he was doing was working for the government because he'd never got to make a decision. Every year they got to make the decisions about what he did. And he said, I'm not doing this anymore. He just hadn't figured out what he was going to do instead. And Frank was similar. But already they were
Australia.
Already they were innovators because they were already building their own equipment for some of their selective Enterprises at that time anyway. Dad was already, the almond harvesting operation was all hand done, and it was just starting to become mechanized, and some of the early models were pretty hopeless and pretty brutal to the trees. And so Dad was already with the manager he had designing and building better and more efficient tree knockers and sweeps and pickups, and that was just, it was in his blood.
What did, like, when he started farming in Australia, do you recall what he said about the opportunities here and what it was about Australian agriculture and cotton production here that was different to America?
When we came here, he didn't know either. So the reason they came as partners was because they did an initial visit, had a look around. They got taken by New South Wales Department down to the MIA, to the southern region, and that was the problem. They developed that, and the snowy scheme was finished. They then went about buying tracts of land and delivering off-river delivery systems of irrigation water to farms, which they'd subdivided into 400-acre farms. Those guys down there didn't want a bar of it either, because partly it was foreign to them, but mostly they're happy doing what they're doing and just weren't interested. So it was all starting to look a bit like a white elephant. The snowy scheme was fine, but they'd spent a lot of money on the delivery system, and it just, no one wanted anything to do with it. So they were trying to attract any interest in irrigation farming in New South Wales to that region. And Dad and Frank just said, that's great, appreciate it, and we'll even go down there and have a look with you, and that way we can actually show you why it won't work. The varieties were just totally unsuitable for that shorter summer, and the climate was just way too short a summer. And 2 years later, after we got established, after we started to get established, and we actually went to the trouble of leasing a farm down there and attempting to grow a cotton crop down there, and it was a financial failure. And we said, look, we didn't orchestrate that result. That's the best we could do. It would not work. So it got left at that, but that was the problem. So when they came here, they had no idea other than they agreed with Nick Derrera in that this was the perfect climate. All the weeds here were the same weeds they were contending with in California, so they thought it's got to be the same climate, grows the same weeds, and they're just as healthy. The soils were better than ours in California, and there was a water supply. So they thought, well, he's ticked all those boxes. The only trouble is there's no infrastructure, and there's no support, so the challenge is going to be to build a critical mass of participants fast enough that we can build the infrastructure post-farm gate and pre-farm gate in suppliers of inputs so that all this is going to work. And if that hadn't happened, it would have failed anyway. So there was about three major challenges in setting out to do it. However, they did one visit. And we're only here for a week or 10 days. Went home, thought about it, didn't talk about it for several months, and then got together and said, we really should go and have a second look. So they came back, and a week after they got here, they rang their wives and said, guess what? We just bought a farm. So that's how much they knew about Australian agriculture, other than what they gleaned in 2 one-week-long visits.
What was your teenage years like?
The what?
What were your teenage years like here as your dad was establishing the business or the industry?
It was not surprising. There was an attitude that everyone was welcoming. Personally, they were all welcoming. They made everybody welcome in both families, and there's a lot of immigrants that moved in behind us, having heard what we did, all felt the same about California. And so there was like 30, 40 families descended on Wee Waa in the next 3 years. Some of them went home again, but that's how fast it started to happen. And it only took a year or so before some of the locals said, I'm over this boo-hoo and tall poppy syndrome, because the perception being passed around was that these Americans are coming in here, they're going to spend a lot of money, go broke, leave a lot of debt, and hightail it back across the water and leave everybody high and dry. And that kind of stuff sticks. So we were continuing with that. Personally, everyone was happy and friendly, but there was an undertone. And the undertone was not spoken to their face, but it was enough that, interesting, my first year of school here was last year of primary school, which was in Weewaw, and I was ostracized and picked on, and I just wanted to die, except for a high school student decided after watching all this go on for about 3 or 4 months, stepped in and told everyone to back off. So I survived. But the teenage years, there wasn't a high school in Weewaw in those days. So my high school years were in the state school in Narrabri. And that was good timing because the headmistress came in and ran the school just as I went there. And she was brilliant and ran a great school. So I had a great time.
And going from there to University of New England, you started off studying, I think it was an ag economics degree or something similar to that. And you worked out that actually what you were quite driven with what you wanted to get in terms of the skills to actually run a business, and the uni wasn't offering it. So you actually came up with a proposal to the university. Talk me through that story.
So it actually happened to two of us at the same time. A relation of my dad's partner in California had followed over as well, but they didn't move here. They moved to Queensland. But Fred and I ended up going to Armidale Uni at the same time and coincidentally had applied for the same degree course, Ag Economics. And within 6 months of starting through for U1, we're just sitting down the back of Bruin's Bar one night over a beer and said, I'm sick of this. I'm not doing this. It's wrong. And Fred goes, oh, I thought I was the only one that thought that. So we started comparing notes It was too basic. A lot of the components of a ag economics degree were just too basic. There was just no meat to them. And it was largely around livestock as well. And we were farmers. And we identified where it was missing the mark. And so we actually had to scramble a little bit to even pass first year because we'd lost interest in everything except football, women and beer. So
I need to ask you, what kind of football by this stage? Were you a true Australian? Was it rugby or were you still watching?
No, it was rugby.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but I'd never played in high school because it wasn't available in Narrabri.
Yeah, gotcha.
But I got to uni and they were all playing this rugby union. I thought, that looks pretty cool. It didn't take me long to hook into that. So we got to the end of first year and had actually just scraped through, and we had to wait for our results to be sure because neither one of us were confident. And when we did, we made an appointment with the dean in January to go back and talk to him about this issue. And I think the only reason we got a hearing, in fact, was because he was the patron of Rob College Football Club. So we actually knew him, and I'm pretty sure we wouldn't have got an interview otherwise. But he said, I'll give you 15 minutes on Thursday, the 10th of January. And we went, okay, don't think we're going to get through this in 15 minutes, but we'll give it a go. So we went totally prepared for 15 minutes. We just put in front of him a piece of paper and said, there's 32 units and they all have a reason why they're important written beside them. And so we just threw it at him. He goes, woo, we need to talk through this. So we're there for 3 hours. And in the end, he said, we said, we just want an education and how to run a small business in a rural environment in Australia. And ag economics is not it because it's got no law, it's got no tax law, it's got no company law, it hasn't got any accounting, it hasn't got business management, it has got very little marketing, and we're not just talking about running a farm. It wouldn't matter what you're doing. If you go back to Narrabri in the 1970s and wanted to run a small business, ag economics was not going to equip you to do it. You'd be left floundering with every service supplier that you wanted to deal with because you wouldn't know whether he's telling you the truth or not. So he came around and he said, yeah, you make a good point. But the problem is this covers 5 faculties. How are we going to possibly do that? Because there's clashes everywhere. We said, that's our problem, Dean, not yours. We'll deal with that. And he goes, but it doesn't fit any degree. And we said, yeah, we know that too. We suspected you might be worried about that. He goes, no, you have to be pursuing a degree at UNO. You don't come here for any other purpose. Okay. So we said, well, what's it close to? He said, well, it's actually pretty close to an economics degree. He said, but it needs two more economics, pure economics units. And we said, like, what's the choices? He said, and he rattled off five units. And we looked at each other. We said, we'll take that international marketing one and this other one. And he said, right, what are you going to cancel? I said, nothing. You're not getting it. We want all those other 32 to help us run a small business in a rural environment in Australia. And he goes, so you're going to do 34 units for a 32-unit degree? We said, if you insist. So we agreed. The fun part was we both passed it and got on with our lives. But the fun part was about 7 years later, I happened to be reading through some material from UNE, and they developed and were putting out for offer a degree called an applied economics degree, and the core subject base of that was exactly the sheet of paper we put on his desk 6 years before. I thought, how cool.
Writing university degrees. Yeah. Now, so what is it about you, James, like when there's a problem placed in front of you that you'll just find a way, like this determination to find a way through it?
It can be driven by a need, or it can be driven by you told me it can't be done. And Dad was the same. You didn't tell Dad it couldn't be done. And I just grew up that way, no? And maybe it can't be done, but I'm going to find out.
Yeah.
And so we got told that one classic was that we got involved in some aquaculture down in Tasmania back in the 90s, and it was being supported and run by some Japanese researchers, and they were still, two of them were still on staff when I got involved. And I said, why the hell do we try and sort and grade scallops out of the water? It's killing them, literally. There's a percentage of them that are dying. You can't keep them out of the water that long. And I said, well, that's the cost of that's what you do. I said, well, what, there's got to be a way to do this underwater. And the Japanese said, if there was a way to do it underwater, the Japanese would have figured it out a long time ago. And I said, well, I would have thought you would have too, but because you guys are the experts, but clearly you haven't. And he said, no, it can't be done. I went, oh, you should not have said that. So Dad was away sailing around the Indian Ocean somewhere at that time. But when he got back, I said, do you want something to do, Dad? He goes, yeah. I said, come and share a red with me and we'll talk about this scallop sorting underwater. And so we were playing around with figures and pictures and stuff. And he got really interested, and I thought he would because he was looking for something to do. And I said, how about we go and sort this out? And he said, what do you mean go? I said, well, how about you and Mum move down to Tasmania for 6 months? And there's a few other things I want you to sort out with the business as well. And we'll just sort this one out for a start. And we'll get you a house to live in. And he said, that sounds like fun. So I went down there and played some more with it. And we had the conceptual idea pretty well sorted. So then we took it back to the Japanese, and they just said, no, that won't work. And if it would have worked, we'd have figured it out. And we thought, okay. So we went to a local engineer in Troyabana and said, were you prepared to help us with this? Because we need a workshop. And he said, sure. Can I make a bob out of this? And we said, sure. But you're not expected to do it for nothing. We're doing it for nothing, but you don't have to. So away we went. And it took... So Dad stayed there. I was back here most of that time, but he kept telling me where we were up to, and we'd throw in ideas back and forth. And in the end, they did it. They created, and it just, it went to Japan. We know it did. And they said, why don't you patent that? And we go, yeah, right. Hey, stop people building their own sorter when it's that easy.
Yeah.
So we never bothered, but we know it spread around the Japanese industry.
It can be done.
Yeah, it can be done.
What were your career aspirations as you, like, the degree you designed was to run a small business in rural Australia, but what your dad was establishing and playing a key role in establishing the cotton industry here. What were your aspirations as a young fella stepping out into the world?
I didn't have aspirations of being an industry leader until I became one. And that opportunity came about when I was asked to consider taking on a directorship of Cottonseed Distributors. Country Distributors is the only seed supplier to the cotton industry in Australia. So they are a monopoly, which was never to our liking, but there was nothing we could do about it because the landscape was, we were so competitive that no one wanted to be against us. So any other seed company just left the country, and two of them did. But it became entrenched as a party to the structure of the cotton industry in that there are three, these days, very prominent entities at the top of the industry that collectively and collaboratively run the industry. So you had the cottonseed business, you had the CIDC, and you had Cotton Australia. And Cotton Australia's largest responsibility is advocacy, and they just do that really well. And then, but we, and CIDC is obvious research and government funded largely. CSD is not funded anything other than by seed and traits. So the three of them collaborate so that there's not overlapping, there's not duplication, and there's no gaps. Years ago, we lost the CRC, the Cotton Communities
Research Corporation.
Yeah, something.
Ish.
Oh, dear, that's terrible. It met a demise because there was no further funding. We couldn't get a renewal. And while that was a bit disruptive and very sad for some people, but the getting on with life, we identified the gaps that was going to leave, and the other three picked it up. And some of that was done in a joint venture activities between the other three. So Cottonseed Distributors became an increasingly important link. And I was invited to become a director of that. And it was only a very short period of time, a year or two before I was vice chair. And then I was the successive chair after that. And I stayed there for 19 years. And that period of time was overlapping with other things I was doing. And it was a crazy lot of fun, which is why I just love what I do. I get to have all kinds of fun and call it work. I can be out at 4 a.m. and clearing a drain pipe in the bottom of a field with spiders and crap crawling all over me with somebody else giving me a hand. And 5 hours later, be in a boardroom with the coat and tie on, talking to the global managers of Bayer. Quite a contrast, but that was life. It's been my life, and I just love it.
What is it about agriculture? Like, what has it enabled for you?
To have fun. No, I do. I just really enjoy what I do. I love farming. Always have. We have a family farming business here, and I took that on. Dad pretty well handed that over when he's in his mid-50s. It's yours.
And how old were you at that stage?
Late 20s. I'm about 3 years home out of uni. And since then, we've been operating. At that time, we were nearly insolvent. About 10 years later, I'm sure we were, but I wasn't asking too many questions because the bank was still on our side. So, and not to say that can't happen again because it's agriculture. But so we've had a roller coaster ride. There's some good times and some not so good times. But even in the not so good times, it doesn't stop you being positively minded about let's make it better. And that might soften the next bad time. And CSD was the same. It was struggling. I mean, its livelihood was seed sales. So if there was no water, there was no seed sales, there was no income for CSD, and it got pretty ugly. But the good thing about that experience and the what that allowed me to help do, because pretty much in everything I've ever done, is not me on my own. I can't think of anything I've ever done exactly on my own. What I've been blessed with is ability as a leader to get good, really good people around me and make things happen. And CSD is exactly that. So I was steering the ship, but I was down the back with the rudder. There's other people up the front. And they were more the face of CSD than I was, but that's fine. I didn't have to be the face of CSD. But we restructured the business where it was no longer just a seed company. It became a crop management company, and it's now producing digital apps that are sought after all around the world because they actually work. And the only reason they work, it's not rocket science. We went about developing and building 8 years worth of data before we built the apps. And everyone else in the world wants to build shiny little apps that don't work because their data source is models. So models are only as good as somebody made up to put in it. But and it's just taking the time to do it right and get it right in the first place. So it was really good fun building that business up. And it's now we got to the point in the early 2000s, about 6 or 7, when we actually didn't have much capital. But it became very aware that also that was just building into the serious part of this dry cycle that we've just had for the last 20 years up until 2020. And that was in the early part of that. And so we weren't doing all that well because people weren't buying much seed. But it's also when we became very much aware that the Commonwealth government, who funds CSIRO research, was being quite flippant and radical, irrational at times, about whether they're going to be in agricultural research or not. And so one year you go, yeah, no, that's all the go. They must have needed to vote somewhere. And then the next thing you know, there's talk about just cutting it all together. We thought, well, the problem with all that is that it was a CSIRO's breeding program that was the backbone of the cotton industry, because they were just ticking boxes like you wouldn't believe. And we had a great team there, always have had, still have. Most remarkable breeders, some of the best in the world, and still are. It would have been really tempting, and there would have been plenty of participants if it was an opportunity for the likes of multinationals like Bayer, Monsanto, or Syngenta, Ciba Geigy, all those guys would have loved to have just thrown a check at the Australian government and said, we'll buy that off you.
Mm.
And that would have been the end of the cotton industry's comfortable position as well. Wouldn't have been at the end of the industry, but it would have been made it uncomfortable. So we tried to buy it. And, of course, we got the obvious answer, like, hell, you're buying it. We said, okay, well, let's get serious in about how we do something together. So one of the greatest things we pulled off, which was under the chairmanship of John Grellman, but I was vice chair by then, and we developed, which still exists today and is now held up by CSIRO as being the best example of the model of doing business with between research agencies and corporations and private sector money. And the reward return for CSIRO is as great as it is for the other participant and for the industry. And the best part about all of it is we locked it in to the point that no one else can buy it without us refusing to buy it. So it can never be lost to the industry. And that was just such an important step. And that's how it exists today. That set of agreements, and it's just a joint venture. It's not even an entity. We don't have a tax file number. It's just a joint venture. But it's renewed in advance, and it's currently renewed well into the 2030s because everybody likes it so much. And it's more than likely that in another 10 to 15 years, it'll have surpassed the income stream of CSIRO's inventing Wi-Fi.
Wow. Remarkable.
Yeah, it is. It is. So boards and CEOs of CSIRO these days go, this is how we want to do research.
Do a bit more of this.
Yeah, and, a bit more
a little
of
bit
this.
Less of that.
Yeah, so it's great fun setting that model up. And then, of course, you've got to keep it relevant. So it's constantly being adjusted and reviewed and made relevant to all parties and keeping everybody happy in the tent.
Hi, I'm Pia, horticulture and sugar analyst at Rabobank, and I'm here to share our latest insights on Australia's vegetable market. Did you know in 2023, Australia produced over $5.8 billion worth of vegetables, though only 4.3% of this was exported? Like many other countries, the Australian vegetable industry relies mostly on its domestic market. In fact, only 7% of global vegetables produced are traded between countries. But we are starting to see that trend change. Global trade is growing at a faster rate than production, and countries with low-cost production are seeing the highest growth rates. You can learn more about trends in the vegetable market on our latest Rabo Research Australia podcast, Mapping World Vegetable Trade, or reach out to me via the Rabobank Australia social media channels to learn more.
You've always, well, I'll say you've always because it's what you told me, but in terms of, as we've been chatting over the last few days, about the importance of things being good for the industry and not about individual competitors. I think it's really interesting how you look at your business and you say, well, we don't actually have competitors because of we're all in it together, marketing together.
At a farming level, it never ceases to amaze me, and in some cases it does amaze me, that might be a bit strong, how so many farmers think the guy across the fence is a competitor, so I'm not going to share my ideas with you. And if you think I'm going to tell you what I put on that crop to make it yield an extra ton of the hectare, go to buggery. That's my secret. I go, he's not your competitor. Canada is your competitor for durum. Russia's your competitor for basic milling wheat, not your neighbour. So where's that mentality coming from? But it's entrenched. There's just so many agriculturalists, and it's not healthy because while you're not sharing, you're not improving each other. And you're not even allowing yourself to improve because you're missing out what he could have been showing you.
Mm.
And the GRDC are doing their best to break that down with all the field work they're doing. And they do a bloody good job of it too. But it's a big challenge.
Well, and I know that they've just, we missed out on it, unfortunately, which is a bit of a sore point. No, but they're investing hugely in terms of communication channels. So upping their podcasts and their videos to actually get that information in front of growers. What's it going to take? Like obviously the leadership, but what's it going to take to, if you had a magic wand and could wave it, like what would be something that you'd change or implement to make Australian agriculture more collaborative?
The biggest hurdle is individuals' perceptions. So, and I'm not quite sure how you change that because it's different from different people. Some people a good conversation will swing them around to thinking something different. Mm-hmm. Others are just so entrenched you can't. But what will help, the reason the American model works so well, and it does, because they've actually got political sway at federal level. They can swing an election. The farmers of America can swing an election. Australian farmers couldn't do in an election. So the difference is that the industry structures are very clear, very concise, and at the top there's one. Too many Australian industries have a collaboration of a combination of several different peak bodies or nearly peak bodies that aren't actually working that greatly together, and it's really easy for a government to divide and rule that. I'll give you an example, a more basic regional example of that. So in the about 20 years ago, I'm very much involved in water issues, as you have to be if you're an irrigator, otherwise you have no water left at all. In the Namoi Valley, there are four water use source groups. So you've got the river system, the unregulated stream system, the groundwater system of the lower Namoi, and the groundwater system of the upper Namoi. And there are four different associations, one for each of those. The obvious thing to me always was that why have we got four? It's basically the same water source. It's rain falling on the Namoi Valley. So why are we duplicating and why are we fighting each other? When you looked into it, which I did, and some others with me, the obvious answer was that divide and rule. Every time the department came out to give us more bad news, they would tell the lower Namoi groundwater users that they couldn't do anything about it because it was those blokes in the upper Namoi that caused the problem. And they'd tell the river water users that it was the problem of the groundwater users, and they did it all the time. And it was pretty easy to discover because all you had to do was be a participant in more than one of those groups and turn up at the meetings to hear them tell you one day how good you are and the next day how you're the worst bastard in the world to a different group of people. So in the late 90s, there were several of us from those different groups, tried to persuade the groups to join together, simplify our administration, simplify our representation, make it one body and all be part of that and have it in the constitution that none of those four groups could be ever diminished out of their right to be involved and be influential in that group. That was all locked in. It failed. The first attempt failed. We were hugely disappointed, but we let it go and stopped beating that drum for about 5 or 6 years. And then there was an instance where the government got really, the government representatives, Department of Water representatives, got really sloppy. And they came up and blatantly did the same divide and rule activities, but it was so blatant that they were being really careless. And it just angered so many people. So the small group that had tried to do it before got back on the wagon, got back on the phone, and we put it together with support in 2 weeks. So hence Nemoi Water, which is representative of all three of those groups. Those four groups all have places on the board of Nemoi Water, and Nemoi Water is the voice of irrigators of the Nemoi Valley and wider in a lot of circumstances. The department can't divide and rule anymore because the Nemoi Water executive are at all those meetings and just go, "What? No, hold on, you can't say that." And the ministers now sit up and have a listen because Nemoi Water actually speaks with authority. That's what agriculture largely needs. We don't need multiple groups. We need multiple groups feeding into a body that actually has a hearing at levels that make decisions that matter. And we just, in so many industries, we don't have that. In cotton, we do.
I was going to ask you, while we're talking about water, because I think it's really, well, it'd be interesting for you to explain, but cotton gets a lot of, I guess, eyeballs on it in terms of consumers and the broader Australian public looking at it going, cotton's bad, Australia's the driest country, continent in the world, blah, blah, blah. How does the whole water system work? How does it work whether you decide you grow cotton, you grow lots of cotton, or you grow none year to year?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the answer is not complicated, but the perception is really quite muddy. And that's orchestrated by the people that want to create the bad perception. And that is also really easy to do if you speak first. So then any refute by the cotton industry is goes, "Oh, you guys are just sour grapes because you got caught out." And the people making the statements in the first place absolutely know that. They're just playing that game. So it's a difficult one. But the answer is, and to the point that there are a lot of cotton growers when introduced to metropolitan social groups and in groups that they become mixed with, they will actually deny the fact. No, they won't deny. They will not put forward the fact that they're a cotton grower. Yeah. They'll put forward the fact that they're irrigating crops.
Yeah.
But they won't mention cotton because they're just going to cop flak over the whole dinner party, which has happened to all of us some point or another. And so you tend to avoid it. I don't. I got thick skin. But but the answer to your question, the second part of your question, is really simple. And it's in here as well. The answer is that you will grow, and any irrigator will grow, the crop that produces the best return. Now, that varies, and generally speaking, that's why, particularly where the climate's right, there's cotton is such a proper popular crop, because very commonly, cotton is the most profitable crop to grow per hectare. But if there's a water shortage and you're being limited on your production across your whole enterprise by the lack of water, in fact, cotton is not the highest return per megalitre. So there are other crops. The classic one is mung beans. You can make 2 to 250% better return on mung beans per megalitre than you can out of cotton. But it's only about a quarter of the return per hectare.
Okay.
Got that?
Yep.
Yep. So cotton's producing.
So you're growing more, in a nutshell, you're growing more mung beans per megalitre of water, but you can grow a lot more cotton per hectare than you can grow mung beans per hectare.
And cotton's worth more.
Gotcha.
So the profit per hectare. So it comes back to a decision on what are your restraint resources. And commonly we believe there are five resources to do what we do as irrigation farmers in northern New South Wales. And we need land, we need water, we need capital equipment, we need capital, and we need people. Now, whichever one of those is the most constrained is the one that becomes the decision maker. And that can change within a calendar year, within a budget. It doesn't normally, but because you can normally see further ahead than that. But if that ever changes, then so do your decision patterns. So when you say, what do we choose to grow? It depends on how much water we've got. But so there was a period, it's happened twice in the last 20 years, where with the dry cycle, we were running out of water. And we had plenty of people, we had plenty of land, we had all the equipment, and we weren't going to leave them sitting idle. So we were growing four times as many hectares of mung beans with the same water that we could grow 1 hectare of cotton. So we could keep at least 2/3 of the farm employed, land, capital, machinery, people, by doing that. Instead of, if we'd have just grown cotton, there'd have been people had to be laid off, machinery would have been sitting idle, land would have been laying fallow, and the soil health would have been deteriorating because of that. None of those things are working. So those five constraints, those five resources, just simply our decision-making comes back to whichever one's constrained.
And it seems like a very rational decision-making. Do you have an emotional tie to one of those five key areas more than another?
I say no. I say with a little bit of pride, I've never sacked anyone in my whole life. And now, that's not to say I haven't encouraged people to leave and actually help them find another job, because this one wasn't working for him or me. And so I'll help them move on, which is different to saying there's the gate, piss off. But of course, people are very important to us. And really are, because we do a lot of work more and more these days with developing people and people's skills in agriculture and managing the style of agriculture that we're involved in. And we're training them. And there's over 10% of our staff are trainees. And it gets up to 15% regularly. And that's kind of pushing the limits because you're running out of resources to maintain that. But that's how important it is to us. If the cash flow is not all that great for 4, 5, 6 years and the machines are getting a bit of age, we'll nurse them through. So they don't have to be turned over unless circumstances prevail. But so I guess really, people would be the one. The water's the most critical to an irrigation farmer, but and decision-making, but We just go out of our way not to put people off because they're just too important. In the 2010-11 flood, we'd already had 10 years of dry cycle, and it got those years I mentioned earlier, 7, 8, and 9, got really nasty, and we were down to minimal production. There's no way with groundwater only, which is only about 20% of our water supply, and then we got down to that. There was no river water at all. And we can't make a profit at that level, but we still refuse to put people off. But what happened was some left, some decided to go and do something else, some retired, and we ended up with about 2/3 of our staff left. And it didn't matter because there was nothing to do. So it just relieved the pressure of finding them something to do and trying to support them when I didn't have a profitable budget. So I did that. 2010-11 flood came along, suddenly we were at 100% of water supply. There's nothing wrong with the equipment. The land was prime. We were not at full production for a year and a half after that because we didn't have the people. So we couldn't do it. And there was no way we were going to flog the ones that were left here to try and do it. We said, can't be done. We just got to work our way back into that. And everyone was in the same boat, so trying to find help in 2012 was crazy stuff.
Fighting for everyone. What's next, or what does the future of your business here look like? You've got one, two sons?
Three.
Three sons back in the business now. What does that evolution of your business here look like?
Really, really strong and really and a lot more fun. It's going to be, it's really positive. The when they were going through high school, there's three boys under three. The third one's 10 days younger than the first one's third birthday. So they went through high school together. They had a lot of fun at TAS, and it was great on weekends because their mother and I only had to take them to one sport, one venue, because they were all doing the same thing. Halfway through high school, I recognized a pattern in their development, and they were all totally different. Except that they did get on really well and looked out for each other when they were at boarding school. I thought, well, that's a plus. But there was one that was clearly going to be academic and administratively very sound. There was one that was just hands-on, he actually wanted to be a pilot, but he ended up becoming the farmer. And the other one was tearing apart remote control toys at 4 years old and rebuilding them into something else. So then, okay, there's a mechanic and there's an IT guy.
Yeah.
And as they're finishing high school, that's where they're all headed. So Daniel went off and did a business degree, and he's now running the administration and business management of the family farming business. Sam is the farmer, which came as a bit of a surprise to him as well. But 2 years after he finished high school, he worked out that he actually loved growing stuff. So he's now the farmer. And Matt is maintenance, IT, and harvesting. Just loves harvesting equipment.
Yeah, okay.
So they got three different jobs as a management team. They're all home. When we have a management meeting, it's really fun because they all want to know what each other's doing, updated on what's going on in your world. But never once in the 7 or 8 years they've been home have any of them ever seriously questioned what one of the others is doing and why, because they don't want their job. They're really happy in their space. And they go, well, if that's what you and Dad figured out, then it must be right.
And so what's your role in this? Are you the coach?
If you look at our organisational chart, I am actually still at the top, thank you very much.
Yeah.
And I think I'm called managing director even.
Oh, there you go.
That when they came home, the reason, the prompt for them to come home when they did, which was around 2015, 16, was that in late 2014, our neighbours, and incidentally it was Dad's partner, the Hadley family, decided to sell off the last of their land. And they'd been doing that for a while, but they kept the land in the Namoi till last. And they offered it to us as a single lot parcel. And they said, if you want to break it up, you don't get it. If you want it all, you can have it. So it took a whole week to negotiate that deal. But part of the week
long
was
by your books.
part of that week was getting the boys home and saying, here's a proposition. What do you think? And they were pretty excited about it. And I said, well, that's interesting because so's the bank. And they went, well, what's your problem? I said, my problem is I'm 65, and unless you guys are coming home, I'm not doing this because I don't want to be here in 7 years' time on my own. I just don't want to be here in my 70s running all this by myself. It won't be quite as much fun as it used to be. And they said, oh, Dad, we're coming home. I said, okay, good. So they did. So that's what brought them home, and they're just flying. I told them at the time, when we settled down into it and worked out roles and worked out salaries, of course, and it's a single business. We don't divide farms. So the 8 farms are all a collaborative of a single business.
Mm-hmm.
There's 3-4 subsets of management territory.
Yep.
But the farming's all managed by Sam. The administration and business management is all done by Daniel. The maintenance and the support is all done by Sam, Matt. All of that is a single unit. And I told them at the time, I said, now, if the big proverbial bus comes along and takes me out any time in the next 12 months, you guys are in the shit. And I mean deep. You're too young, you're too inexperienced, and I don't know how you're going to get through. It'll be really tough. You want to hope that just doesn't happen. In about 2 or 3 years, you'll struggle, but you'll get through, and you'll wish I hadn't died. In about 4 or 5 years, you'll be comfortable that you've got it, but you'll just be a bit tentative. In 6 or 7 years, you'll wish you didn't have to take time off from a funeral because you're too busy running the farm. I said, that's what I reckon. And Sam said, so, Dad, what are you going to do then? And I said, oh, and by the way, in about that time frame, I reckon I'll just become potentially redundant. And Sam goes, so, Dad, what are you going to do then? And his older brother Daniel said, Sam, you weren't listening. He said, potentially, he ain't going nowhere. And he's right. We're at that point. They are running the show. I get the pleasure of ringing them up and saying, what do you want done this week? Because I've actually got about 4 days free. And they know not to give me all the shit jobs, but some of them aren't all the glamorous ones either. And so this morning I was changing siphons at 4 o'clock in the morning, so that's okay. And I don't mind that because I balance that with sitting in a boardroom with somebody else. And I just think it's a great experience and great life because I get time to think while I'm doing either one of those jobs. I've got time to think about what I'm doing, other things that I'm doing, where the business is going. It's we're just trying to we believe we're very close to the scale of operation we think is ideal. So we haven't got great growth aspirations much anymore. Mm-hmm. That could change, but this is the current thinking. And they're also starting to build families, so they don't wish to be at work 15 hours a day either. So I just think it's more of the same, but more of the same means that we just keep looking on how to improve what we're doing way and beyond where we were 5 years ago. Most recently, a few years ago, we had one of the farms become accredited as carbon positive.
Yeah.
Better than neutral. Last year, we had our whole farming operation across all 8 farms, our management systems, declared carbon neutral.
I want to ask how. What have you guys done in order to be able to become carbon neutral?
Partly is retaining and looking after and improving our riparian zones, which we don't cultivate anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's stocking areas. But we're also collaborating with Landcare and Country Road, and people like Country Road now want to tick that box.
Yep.
And so they're getting involved, supporting financially activities in several different regions in New South Wales, and I believe they're moving into Queensland with that effort as well. So that's going on. But we've been doing that for 15 or 20 years before that came along. So we've got a pattern of developing that for a long time. The soil carbon building has been going on since we were in New England running sheep in Ben Lomond, and we thought that's when the first chatter about all the carbon and the carbon credits and how you're going to make a mozza out of selling them and all that kind of chat was going on with no substantial evidence of any of it, but it was good chat. And we thought, I wonder how that really would work. So we started looking and testing our soils up there in the mid-90s on this grazing country. And by early 2000s, we'd built that up from 0.04 up to about 0.8. And we thought, we'd doubled it. And we thought, that's cool. And we'd done that with holistic management and just simple grazing techniques like eat a third, trample a third, leave a third, and just building organic matter in the soils as working really well. It was difficult to do out here because of the dry cycle, and that becomes really difficult to maintain soil carbon, let alone build it, because you're not growing crops.
Yeah.
So it's pretty hard to do. But in 2020, we could see the end of the dry cycle coming and beginning of a decent wet cycle. So we started actively testing soils here on Wee Wall Farming, and found it to all be around about 0.5, 0.6 after extensive dry cycle. And I thought, yeah, I wonder what it was before that, because it would have been pretty nice. Anyway, we've already built that up to 1.4.
Yeah, wow.
In about 2.5 years. And that's just by that rotation program that we use that is loaded with, we grow 5 crops in 4 years. And the rotation cycle is designed to rotate chemistry, both herbicides and insecticides. So there's a whole 18 months of it that we don't use Roundup. And that's pretty hard to do these days in agriculture. But in that cycle, there is a period where Roundup doesn't go near that paddock. And then it's also rotating the amount of organic matter we're putting back into the crop. Mung beans put bugger all in, but corn puts massive amounts in. So that's all happened. It's breaking the disease cycle. Mm-hmm. So some of them are semi-host to some of the diseases that cause us a fair bit of grief. Others are not. So it's rotating that. And and it's just developing farming systems that retain the stubble, but we're not no-till. Can't be in irrigation. It's too tough. And I wouldn't want to be anyway. So we're minimum till, so we'll plant. Two of those 5 crops go straight into stubble of the crop before them. The other 3 are behind tillage that turned all that into the soil so we can get on with rotting it down and creating carbon loads instead of rubbish on top.
So can I ask, do you foresee like in the next dry period that your carbon levels will actually drop again? And is there a risk of not maintaining carbon neutrality for a short period of time?
I would expect that's possible. Yep. You can't control that situation if you can't grow anything.
Yep.
And cropping, it's been long known, Longfellow syndrome is just nasty. But if you have got no moisture to grow crops with, that's what you end up with, regardless of how good an operator you are. So it's possible. But we won't anticipate it because we will be anticipating that potential scenario before it happens and be trying to create a loading of carbon that might carry you through.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah.
And that's where you'd be willing to change the type of farming as you lead into a potential dry cycle?
Yep.
Okay.
That all works.
So, well, a couple of questions, I guess, to wrap. But if you were getting back into agriculture today, if you were stepping out of the golden gates of university again and you could do absolutely anything in agriculture today, what would be an area you think you'd pursue?
It's a bit like the owner in your house. And if you've got a dream that you're going to own your own farm, that's a really tough call and you're going to need a lot of help somewhere along the way to achieve that. But I just don't, and you see a lot of people now that have recognised the fact that you can actually get satisfaction and enjoy what you're doing by just having a responsible job of managing tracts of property, as long as you've got a decent landlord or a decent boss. I know lots of people that just go, you know, this is the best of both worlds because I don't have the worry of it all going pear-shaped. So if it does pear shape, I'm not wearing it. Mm. I just think that the opportunities in ag are the same as they were, except if you've got a hell-bent desire to own your own place, then you're beating your head a bit. Otherwise, take your pick. There's I don't know an ag industry in Australia that doesn't need good management and will pay for good management. And the rewards and job satisfaction in good run organizations will make that pretty comfortable without the risks.
Yeah. So one final question then. You'll be heading overseas, I presume this year, 2024, on the trip. What are you most looking forward to when you get to mingle with the group of winners again?
What do you know that I don't know? I don't know when we're going, but there's been no dates mentioned.
Presumably this year.
So it might be this year. I really enjoy that. I got to do a lot of that when I was the lead of CSD. We had international relationships with Monsanto, Bayer, Cibagoge, Syngenta, with all the heavy hitters, because they're all in the same industry we are, and we're doing things that that mean that we need them, and quite regularly they need us, because we're supplying the best germplasm in the world to all the leading cotton producing countries, except the ones that don't recognise the contract. But the rest of them, that's where we are. That's where CSD is, and that's what we were doing. And so we had the benefit of experiencing a lot of travel and mixing with a lot of CEOs and high-level managers of multinationals, and they're really not that ugly and dangerous.
Yeah.
What I really love about all those guys now, and by guys I mean the corporations, and when they keep reducing a number, with we haven't got Monsanto anymore. But even before Monsanto went, so I go back half a dozen years, all the ones that were there then were results of others that merged together prior to that in the last 20 years, and Syngenta is absolutely a product of that. There wasn't a bad attitude before, but I think those majors now all have a really strong desire, a true, honest desire to benefit and make farmers do better. Now, I was in the ag chem game as a distributor all through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and they were my suppliers. I can't say that it was exactly the same honest opinion held by them. They were more interested in the shareholder profits, quite frankly, and the competition was fierce to get it. I think there's a culture change in those big companies, and Syngenta's a classic. They genuinely want to help farming industry. And you could be cynical and say, well, the obvious answer is that if their farmers aren't doing well, they're not buying your product, so you're not going to do well. And that's a truth.
Mm.
But I don't think it's a driving truth that makes these companies do what they do these days. I think they generally have an interest in seeing agriculture do well.
Yeah. I think at the core of it all is they are human beings. And I think when it comes to agriculture, people genuinely care about what it is that they are doing. And I think what's amazing about the bigger end of town is that what they do actually has a global footprint and impact, which is...
They do. And what they do around the world is not a lot different to what they do here. So it's not like they're putting up a front in Australia and New Zealand that they're not backing up around the world. Except, again, I say there's a couple of major countries in the world that don't recognise a contract. So it's pretty hard for those guys who need to earn a quid to do any business there. And frankly, I wouldn't be either. But other than that, that's true. They really do. And Syngenta do a great job of that. And they've been moving in that direction for way more than a decade.
Mm. Well, James, thank you so much. I feel like we're going to have to come back and chat to you again. I think we've only just hit part one of God knows how many parts, but it's been fantastic sitting down with you and hearing a bit of that journey from 10 years old right to where you are today and where the business is heading. So thank you.
Yeah, we skipped a few bits. My pleasure. And thanks for making it so easy. It's been a good discussion. Thank you.
Well, that's it for another episode from us here at Humans of Agriculture. We hope you're enjoying these podcasts. And well, if you're not, let us know. Hit us up at hello@humansofagriculture.com. Get in touch with any guest recommendations, topics, or things you'd like us to talk and get curious about. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Rate, subscribe, review it. Any feedback is absolutely awesome and we really do welcome it. So look after yourselves, stay safe, stay sane. We'll see you next time. See ya.